This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Heart Greens. Helping to support healthy blood pressure and circulation just became hassle-free. Introducing Heart Greens, the functional food that you drink using the same dark leafy greens recommended by both the DASH and Mediterranean diets. Get a free canister of Heart Greens with your first order and a 100% money-back guarantee. Heart Greens even guarantees you'll love the taste. Call 800-951-8940. That's 800-951-8940. Or visit IntelligentGreens.com. That's IntelligentGreens.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about a subject that is very mysterious, little understood, often unrecognized, but it may be relevant to a health problem that you suffer from or someone that is in your circle, a loved one, friend, suffers from. The condition, well, various conditions are grouped under this heading. Pelvic floor disorder, the variety of terms being tossed around, pudendal neuralgia, vulvodynia, pudendal nerve entrapment, or PNE. Vulvodynia may come under this. Even certain forms of prostatitis may come under this. And a wide variety of maladies, sexual dysfunction, urinary dysfunction, bowel dysfunction may fall under this heading. Today we're going to talk to an expert. In fact, she's one of the foremost experts on this subject. She's Stephanie Prendergast. She has a master's in physical therapy and is the co-founder of the Pelvic Health and Rehabilitation Center, which has locations in San Francisco, Berkeley, Los Gatos, Los Angeles, and Boston. Stephanie began serving on the International Pelvic Pain Society's Board of Directors back in 2002, so she has a wide depth of experience in this field. There's a Society for Pudendal Neuralgia, which she was invited to become one of the founding board members of in 2005. She teaches a course entitled Demystifying Pudendal Neuralgia. That's a course for health professionals. And she's internationally recognized as an authority in the field of pelvic floor dysfunction. She lectures regularly. She has numerous scientific publications, medical textbooks, journals, and magazines. And she's co-authored the book Pelvic Pain Explained, which, Stephanie, that book is out, correct?
Correct. Came out in January.
Okay. And we're going to talk about what listeners can learn about in the book. But first, you know, help us out with terminology here. All this is under the broad rubric of pelvic floor dysfunction or pelvic floor disorders?
That is correct. And a lot of the things that you mentioned, vulvodynia, pudendal neuralgia, prostatitis, interstitial cystitis, they fall under part of the dysfunction. So under the umbrella of pelvic floor dysfunction, there are pelvic pain disorders, many of which you mentioned. Also under the umbrella of pelvic floor disorders may be something that people more commonly think of, which are things surrounding difficulty after childbirth and issues that women have later in life, such as stress incontinence and pelvic organ prolapse. So those are just two different ends of the pelvic floor dysfunction spectrum.
And so how prevalent is this? Is this a rare entity, or is this something that affects millions of Americans potentially?
This is actually something that's more common than low back pain. So you may not immediately recognize the symptoms of it, but it's estimated per a National Institute of Health study that between 1 in 3 and 4 women between the ages of 18 and 64 will have pelvic pain at some point in their life. The estimated prevalence in men is 8 to 10% for pelvic pain disorders.
So then this is vastly under-recognized, because I think that, you know, if it's really that prevalent, I think that there may be a high percentage of men and women who don't know that a pelvic floor dysfunction may be contributory to their malady.
That is correct. The average number of misdiagnoses a patient receives before getting a proper diagnosis is 5 to 10.
Hmm. So what mistakes do doctors make in misdiagnosing this? Where might they overlook this?
I think we could start with men because that's the easiest and most common with the misdiagnosis. So men in their 20s, 30s, and 40s may experience symptoms of urinary urgency and frequency, genital burning, penile pain, perineal pain, and almost always it's initially thought to be a sexually transmitted disease or infection.
Mm-hmm.
That can obviously be tested and come back negative. The second diagnosis that's often given to these men is non-bacterial chronic prostatitis.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they call it non-bacterial chronic prostatitis because if a semen sample is collected, there's often not an infection. However, many of the times, because of the difficulty testing the semen and getting a proper sample and a clean sample, it's often just anecdotally treated with antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, presumptively. It's like, you have prostatitis, and this is the old drill is, okay, you've got prostatitis, let's give you Cipro, boom. And
exactly.
With all the attendant potential problems associated with antibiotics as well.
And I know you've done a lot of interviews regarding the gut connection to the brain, so you can imagine if a gentleman is treated repetitively with antibiotics, then there is a development of gastrointestinal symptoms, which further aggravates a pelvic floor dysfunction. Constipation, bloating, distress that comes from the result of repetitive antibiotic use, sometimes over the course of a year. We've seen people on continuous antibiotics, unfortunately.
And could this also result in pain on ejaculation or pain on orgasm for men?
Yes, that's a very common symptom of this as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it's okay. That puts a that puts a real dent in your sexual enjoyment as well.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So how might a man be properly evaluated from that? I mean, probably a lot of listeners their ears are perking up saying, hey, I have some of those symptoms, but I wonder, is it appropriate for me to get an evaluation for pelvic floor dysfunction with my symptoms?
Absolutely. So the first thing is to make sure that you are getting tested. You do want to rule out other things such as sexually transmitted diseases. And of course, please do not take antibiotics if there isn't an infection. Some people, there had been theories over the course of the last decade where it was just this undetectable bacterial infection, and we now know that, in fact, that is not true.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there are symptoms of urinary urgency frequency, post-ejaculatory pain, and no other tests are returning positive, it's likely, very plausibly, there could be a pelvic floor dysfunction, and you can see a pelvic floor physical therapist to confirm that. Often people want to see the urologist. Mostly men will go to the urologist first, and contrary to what you may think, depending on their training, they may not actually be trained to do a pelvic floor examination.
Mm.
And in those cases, they can simply take a look at the symptoms and determine if it's warranted to get the evaluation. But a lot of times, depending again on their own usual personal experience versus the standard of care, they may not be aware that pelvic floor dysfunction can cause these symptoms.
And of course
it's frustrating.
Of course, what you've been doing is you've been sort of increasing awareness about this, spreading the gospel about the potential for this to be a contributing factor to men's and women's problems. But so what does a urologist or a physical therapist do to make a proper diagnosis? I have a feeling it has something to do with putting a glove on the hand and, hearing that familiar snap. As the gloved hand approaches certain of your nether parts.
Exactly. So the pelvic floor muscles run from the pubic bone back to the tailbone. And in order to access the muscles, a digital exam is performed. So a physical therapist does apply lubricant to a glove, and then we will do a digital exam where we palpate the muscles for tenderness. We also palpate them for tone. We look at a person's ability of motor control. So we want to know, can this person squeeze on command? Can they relax the muscles on command?
Mm-hmm. That's a so-called Kegel. That's a Kegel maneuver, right? I mean,
a Kegel is called a contraction, correct,
okay.
And usually is almost always contraindicated for these patients. Kegels are the last thing that people with pain actually need to do in many cases, but it's a part of the testing. Often the muscles are too tight, and so we may ask a 30-year-old gentleman who actually runs marathons to squeeze his muscles. He can't. but it's not because he's weak. It's just that the muscles are very tight. Mm-hmm. Those could be compressing the urethra. They could be compressing the pudendal nerve and resulting in things like perineal pain, penile pain, difficulty initiating a urine stream, post-urine dribble after they have completed their stream. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of our male patients, it's mostly tied to some sort of athletic situation.
Yep.
And my suspicion is they're just anatomically predisposed. Some mm-hmm. people's anatomy will not allow them to ride their bike for 50 miles, whereas other people can do that and are totally fine.
Right.
Some gentlemen cannot.
I'm in the lucky ladder category, and that seat is pretty darn hard. But fortunately, I feel a certain soreness afterwards around my zits bones, it hasn't resulted in those annoying symptoms that I know some men experience. And therefore, they have all these differently configured seats that supposedly take the pressure off. Is that a lot of hype, or is there some truth to ergonomic seats to help avert that?
Definitely some truth to ergonomic seats. Everybody's body is different in terms of where their nerves are, how close those nerves are to their sit bones, how far their perineum is from the sit bone. And so with many of our patients, we have been able to get them back to cycling and the things that they love just by modifying certain things based on their specific anatomy.
Mm-hmm. Well, this can result in literally loss of sensation, inability to experience sensation with sex, for example, or loss of erection, impotence, because of pudendal nerve. Tell us what about this pudendal nerve that's so implicated in all these problems.
The pudendal nerve is interesting because it's one of the only nerves in the body that has sensory, meaning it's responsible for sensation, motor, which means it's responsible for muscle function, but then the third is autonomic function.
Mm-hmm.
So similar to how we breathe, we don't have to think about the pudendal nerve doing its job for some of the time, but we could technically override it. Just like you can take a breath on command, you could squeeze your pelvic floor on command. That involves the pudendal nerve. But the problem with this nerve is it does run a very tortuous course through the pelvic floor muscles. It runs through sacroiliac joints. It innervates the urethra, the perineum, the rectum. It's responsible for orgasm. It's involved with the muscles that are responsible for orgasm. It's the reason why we're continent, and it's the reason why in some cases you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And so that nerve innervates the pelvic floor muscle, but also is very closely tied to urinating and bowel movements and things like that. And so just like carpal tunnel, I relate it to that sometimes. I call it carpal tunnel of the butt.
Mm-hmm.
If something happens along the course of this nerve, you may end up with tingling or pain sensations in any of the areas that I just mentioned that it innervates, but also urinary and bowel trouble. So the first end of the spectrum is you actually see urinary urgency frequency,
mm-hmm.
pain with bowel movements, not necessarily incontinence. This is a neuralgia. If the muscles and the nerves get damaged to the point where there's actually a neuropathy, you may then lose sensation. Instead of pain, you have numbness.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having urinary frequency, you may actually have incontinence. These neuropathy situations with the pudendal nerve are most common immediately following childbirth, long second stages of labor. People often think about there can be a transient neuropathy. The other end of the spectrum is with chronic constipation, constant straining over and over again can lead to a pudendal neuralgia. People have long-standing histories of constipation, similar to the labor situation.
And that's a vicious cycle because as you lose control of your sphincter, which I think is somewhat innervated by the pudendal nerve, it makes the constipation
yes.
worse. And one strains more, increases pressure, goes into worse and worse spasm. And that is, perpetuating a vicious cycle.
Correct. Yes. And so, again, we see pain much more commonly than we actually see true neuropathy and incontinence from a pudendal nerve injury. So most commonly we do have, it's a pain situation, but it is a cycle as you described. The muscles get tight, that irritates the nerve further, that irritates the structures further, and then everything is affected. So part of physical therapy intervention is to break that cycle, is to figure out and identify where the specific problems are in the muscles, in the nerve, in the joints, and undo those mechanical
mm-hmm.
compromises.
So really, one of the thorniest clinical problems for general physicians and urologists is male, as you said, non-bacterial prostatitis. And the notion is that maybe we're not finding the bugs. We need to use more and more antibiotics, and more antibiotics are used to no avail. And men describe it as just a very uncomfortable sensation there, maybe a need, a feeling to that they need to urinate all the time, or discomfort when they sit. They're told to take sitz baths. They're told to take antidepressants sometimes because the pain is so bad. But in your experience, is there hope for men who suffer from these chronic disorders through the physical therapy that's offered?
Absolutely. And in the last 5 years, our government has actually funded large multi-center studies, which are looking at both the functional MRI brain scans of men with pelvic pain, as well as pairing that with objective muscular findings. And so, unfortunately, I just think the diagnosis wasn't there initially for men, and they feel very frustrated, like there is no hope. But hopefully, listening to podcasts like this, if they haven't been in contact with somebody who understands, these problems are absolutely treatable.
Okay, and while we'll provide resources, because, you know, as you say, it's an emerging science, emerging understanding, and really that the knowledge about this has not been that widely disseminated through the medical system. And you know, many neurologists now becoming more and more aware of this, and thank goodness for that over the past few years. But sometimes, you know, you reach a dead end with your physician and maybe you need to look further.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So what about you criticize one approach that came into vogue recently, which is surgery for PNE, pudendal nerve entrapment. The notion was, okay, just like carpal tunnel, the nerve gets entrapped. So we, you know, do carpal tunnel surgery on the wrist. We release the pressure on the nerve and it's all good. Is that a solution for many sufferers of this condition?
I think, unfortunately, there was a lot of confusion around pelvic pain diagnoses in general. And initially, and in 1988, roughly, the first thing that was talked about was pudendal nerve entrapment. So early on, there was really no discrimination between what a neuralgia is, what a myofascial pelvic pain disorder is, and erroneously and technically inaccurately, everything was called pudendal nerve entrapment. And because it looked like an entrapment, there was a surgery devised to treat basically all types of pelvic pain, which in hindsight now, and research has shown just many of the cases where there was a diagnosis of pudendal nerve entrapment, it's hard to say if it actually was. And unfortunately, we don't have any diagnostic tests to confirm or refute if a pudendal neuralgia is caused by an entrapment. So until something is surgically looked at, meaning a patient has to undergo surgery to have the surgeon visualize the nerve to determine if this is actually a source of their pain, we have no way of determining that. So we really need to look at the history as well as the physical findings to try to determine if something like an entrapment surgery is warranted. Mm-hmm. But again, erroneously, everything was previously called entrapment. I think many patients had surgery that didn't need to have surgery. And now we're a little more selective and a little more discriminate with who actually should get the procedure.
And
or be considered for the procedure, I should say.
And speaking of, you know, getting the word out, and we want to be accurate in our reporting about this here on Intelligent Medicine, you've been able to share some of this information with the press, but according to some of the stuff you've written, you've been a little disappointed with press coverage. Why do you think the press may be not giving this condition a fair shake?
My experience has been that it just sounds weird and confusing, and it isn't yet in the mainstream, and so I think it's just poorly understood. I think it's poorly understood around medical professionals, and then when we try to take it a step further, I think it sounds like a taboo topic, even though it shouldn't be, just because of the areas where it's affected. I think just across the board, what I observe is there's general confusion. What this is, how it should be treated. A lot of people don't know about pelvic floor physical therapy. It's not always easy to find a pelvic floor physical therapist. It's a completely postgraduate subspecialty of training. So it's not available everywhere is a second issue that I think has arisen.
And also I think some of the coverage has been sensationalistic and basically pointing out that, oh my goodness, you have this terrible malady and it's going to be very, very hard to overcome. And that may further demoralize the patient who's already feeling pretty afflicted.
I agree with that. It's very challenging when a patient recognizes their symptoms to see something published that says that there's no hope and that this isn't treatable and that this is some strange, mysterious disease. It's not. It's just about finding the people who actually know how to treat it. And so I think a lot of the media attention has further contributed to the anxiety and depression that people can feel, and sometimes unnecessarily.
Indeed.
There's always a treatment option, no matter where you live.
And that's what we'll focus on in part two. Our listeners know that we divide these podcasts into two parts. We've laid the groundwork for our discussion. We've talked about men. We've talked about some of the basic terminology surrounding pelvic floor disorder and some of the conditions that it can result in. When we return, we'll talk about solutions. What is pelvic floor physical therapy? And we'll also focus on women's problems because while men suffer from this to a certain extent, I think women are the majority of sufferers of pelvic floor disorder. Agreed?
Agreed.
Okay. When we return, more of our discussion with Stephanie Prendergast. Her book that she co-authored is Pelvic Pain Explained, released in January of this year. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.